The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt in California for a week. But nevertheless, here with the rundown of the headlines. And there are a lot of headlines after yesterday. If you turn on the radio at any time yesterday, you heard people talking about a market crash. Yeah, it was a wild day on the market. Washington Post, Dow sheds more than 600 points in wild trading on China and other economic worries. Wall Street Journal, Hong Kong tycoons won't escape China crackdown. This is all called by Xi. Wall Street Journal, Bitcoin prices slide. Yes, they tumbled all the way down to 43,500. Don't buy Bitcoin if you don't know what it is. China jitters are blamed for Bitcoin. Wall Street Journal, late in the day, stock market pairs losses, but Dow, S&P 500 fall nearly 2%. I will, in fact, make this my market update brought to you by Birch Gold. Since whenever the market news is around, gold goes up. Let me check that for you. In fact, gold did go up. It's at $1,765 an ounce this morning. Not that much, but whenever markets are a little bit, then gold goes up. If you want gold, head to Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. I trust him. That's who I buy gold from. Wealth is made in concentration, but it is preserved in diversification. You ought to be diversified at least into some gold. Your IRA or 401k can be rolled over 5 to 10% of it to a Birch Gold physical account. So do that. HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. From the Financial Times, Wall Street marks biggest drop since May as Evergrande crisis intensifies. You say, what is the Evergrande crisis? A Chinese real estate developer. Yes, in the People's Republic of China. Does it really have anything to do with us? No. In fact, this morning, as we wake up and groggily grab our coffee around the United States, all over England, Germany, and France, Europe has rallied at 1.5% and 1.2% because, you know, the traders want to wipe out people with low stops and stuff like that, or too low stops. And so trading happens. But generally speaking, Americans overreact to everything if Europe is overreacting to everything, if China is. So the financial day begins in Japan, then moves to China. And yesterday, China got the shakes because they're afraid of what Xi is going to do, this giant property developer. And so it just moved all around the globe. And then the next day, it settles down after China's had taken their licking and keeps on ticking. And then everyone says, I guess it's not the end of the world. And they start going back. And so it's a typical thing. Biggest story of the day, Democrats unveil new plan to fund government, suspend debt ceiling as major showdown with the GOP looms. I'll talk about this later. There is no showdown. Nothing is looming. Democrats, do your job. The Republicans aren't going to help you raise the debt limit. They're not going to help you pass the reconciliation. But you can do both. You've got the votes. Work it out among yourselves. You're running everything. Everything is on you. They do note, however, in the Washington Post that after the immigration ruling by the Senate parliamentarian, quote, Democrats' once sweeping agenda continues to shrink. Aren't we sad? But legacy media being legacy media, they do what they always do, which is write the same headline, New York Times, Democrats to pair spending bill with raising debt ceiling, pressuring GOP. There is no pressure. The GOP isn't going to raise the debt ceiling. Mitch McConnell said that months ago. I'll play it for you later. Leader McCarthy said the same month ago. They're not doing it. They're not playing this game. There is no performance theater. Legacy media is trying to create an issue that the Republicans are somehow the problem. The Democrats run everything. The Democrats can raise the debt ceiling. Democrats go raise the debt ceiling. Pfizer biotech suggests that their vaccine triggers a robust response in younger children. Companies say data provides strong foundation to seek authorization to vaccinate 5 to 11-year-olds. I say, roll it out. Roll it out. Let's go. Let's move. I want my grandkids to get this ASAP. But the big issue will be if authorized by the FDA. So once again, the FDA will screw it up, no doubt. They'll mix up the messaging and scare people. And it will take a long time. And meanwhile, the pandemic effects continue to go on because there's more than 80% of the kids who get vaccinated. There'll be 20% who are hesitant, and it will work. It won't work ideally, but it will work. The Biden administration is going to raise the refugee cap to 125,000. I applaud this. This does not apply to the Haitians under the bridge. It does not apply to the border. It does apply to the Afghans that we screwed, who continue to try and get here any way they can. There continue to be horror stories. I will get to those in a moment. After California recall, Democrats fret over Latino vote, as they should. Larry Elder did much better with Latinos than he previously, than any Republican previously had for many years. As across the United States, Latinos begin to vote in larger and larger numbers for Republicans. Joe Biden, we are inflicting him on the United Nations today. I'm sorry to say Joe Biden is going to the United Nations today to deliver his first ever United Nations speech. I think the room might be a little bit empty, or people are going to catch up on their sleep. Justin Trudeau got reelected. Now, remember, they have a parliamentary system. He was in a minority government. He didn't have a majority. He had to always get someone to work with him to pass anything. So he called a snap election because he was up in the polls. He increased his number of seats by one, which means exactly the same result, exactly the same thing. Canada can't make up its mind whether to dump the well, he's just basically a nothing burger. But Justin Trudeau remains on our backs for the foreseeable future. Times of Israel reports an attempted military coup in Sudan, which is sort of like an every other month headline out of Sudan for the last couple of years. Senior sources in armed services say a group of officers were involved in the attempt but immediately suspended. Suspended? You get suspended for a military coup? Guess who won in Russia? Putin's party won in Russia. I don't even know why that's a news story. They pretend that it's an election. But this actually caught my eye from the Financial Times. Rusal strikes deal to supply Budweiser with ultra-low carbon cans. So that can you drink your Bud in? Not only did Budweiser sell out years ago, it's now going to be a Russian can. Budweiser is going to be made in Russian cans. So I guess the ESG policies at Budweiser don't do a lot of business with Russian dictators who murder people with weapons of mass destruction in London. Because I just think this is great. Your Budweiser coming in a Russian can. Here's another surprising headline from the New York Times. A harsh new reality for Afghan women and girls in Taliban-run schools. Afghanistan's new government is likely to severely restrict education for girls and women despite the Taliban's claims that schooling will eventually resume. Are you surprised? You should not be, because medieval theology does not change over 20 years, despite the fighting. Medieval theology is still treat women horribly, treat girls as they don't exist, lock them away and make them leave the house only when fully covered in a burqa and not to go to school, but to do whatever their men and fathers say. We did that. That's on Joe Biden. Thank you, Joe Biden. There's a better story in the Times of Israel with more detail on the Israeli philanthropist, the Israel Aid Organization, and the United Arab Emirates saving the dozen of refugees. And they have a picture of the women athletes, the women robotics team, the human rights activists that the United Arab Emirates and Israel spirited out of Afghanistan. And I salute Israel again. I salute the United Arab Emirates again. And I again say, where are those headlines about Americans doing that? Where are the American headlines? Because we're not doing that because Joe Biden doesn't want to be bothered. Boris Johnson successfully got the United States to let Brits back in the United States. Slow Joe finally said yes. But Boris is not going to get a UK-US free trade deal because, of course, all of the Biden administration's anti-Brexit, and they're still fighting the last war. And then finally, a useful piece of news from the New York Times. The best laser printer. Now, it's always the story you don't expect to see that makes the most difference to you. You know, I really do. There's a printer on the floor in my studio here, and there's a printer in the studio in Virginia, and there's a printer in my backup studio scattered around the country in bunkers everywhere. Should that doomsday ever come, I'll keep broadcasting, provided Dwayne goes to work. Dwayne comes to work less and less. He's a band dad. I found that out over the weekend. I'll talk about that today. But they've reviewed all the printers in the world. every one of them, and they've come up with one printer. They say, the very best. Printers are annoying, they write. All of them. True, true, fact check, true. But if you want to keep your annoyance to a minimum, we recommend a laser printer. Not only do laser models print sharp text and crisp graphics, they also run more reliably than inkjets and won't clog if they sit unused for weeks between jobs. The best laser printer is the powerful, versatile HP ColorJet LaserJet Pro M255DW. It's easy to set up, not true, and simple to use, absolutely not true, and it produces great-looking results, true, both in color and black and white. I wouldn't know, I don't do color printing, but I run off 100 articles a day. So I'm here to tell you, because it's in fact what I have in the studio, the HP Color LaserJet Pro M255DW, endorsed by Hugh Hewitt and the New York Times. What more do you need? Well, more of me. Come back after the break on this Tuesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show, live from California. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95.
And if you want to live high, live high. And if you want to live low, live low. Because there's a million ways to go. You know that there are. You can do what you want.
Welcome back, America, to Cat Stevens Day on the Hugh Hewitt Show. 10,000-word story on Cat Stevens in the Washington Post this morning, the meaning of Cat Stevens. David Drucker is with the Washington Examiner. You can follow him on Twitter, David M. Drucker. He is the author of the forthcoming In Trump's Shadow, the battle for 2024 and the future of the GOP, which drops in 28 days on October the 19th, I believe. Am I right about that, David M. Drucker, In Trump's Shadow on October 19th?
You are right about that, Hugh.
So I'm going to be giving you the casual aside mention in a Washington Post column today about books that I will read about Trump versus those that I won't. One of them is In Trump's Shadow, because you actually know what you're writing about. Is Cat Stevens in your book?
No, but, you know, I now wish I had thought better of it, because I've always been a fan of his music, and I still have this memory from a grad trip I did when I was 18 where one of his songs is playing over the speaker in a restaurant where it's just me and my two buddies and nobody else in the restaurant, and it's just like marked up my brain.
Well, I must say to people of a certain age, you're a little bit young for this, but as I introduce people to the idea, imagine my surprise when I go through my morning discipline, which is Times of Israel, Financial Times, The Telegraph, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The New York Times, just to make sure nothing going on. Up pops 10,000 words on the meaning of Cat Stevens. The meanings of Yusuf, that's his name, his Muslim name, Y-U-S-U-F, Cat Stevens. I said, what? What? He's back? And I mean, Dave, this is a real throwback, right?
Yeah, just proves to you, if you live long enough, if you're lucky enough to live long enough, you will see just about everything, and things that were long gone will come back around.
Yeah, Cat Stevens is back. Now, I want to talk about In Trump's Shadow, because the column today is about books I read and books I don't read having to do with Trump, because my professional obligation requires me to read George Will book, Andrew Sullivan book, Jesse McCarthy's book. I got lots of books to read. I'm always reading. So I can't, this flood of Trump books. And I mentioned two that I will be reading, one by Jonathan Carl from ABC and David Drucker's book, In Trump's Shadow, because both you and Carl actually have sources in Trump world. What is In Trump's Shadow going to be about, David?
Well, it's going to be about the future. So what I tried to do with this book is examine Trump's impact on the party with an eye toward what that means for what comes next and through the prism of what the 2024 primary could look like. And so to the extent that there is reporting in the book, and there's a decent amount of it that comes from the time of Trump's presidency, but even before that, it's really about how a lot of the Republicans that want to run for president in 2024 were preparing to run for president long before Trump left office, and at the same time taking a look at how Trump's rise as a Republican figure and then president impacted and changed a lot of the party, so that we can try and get a handle on what this next generation of the party is going to look like.
You know, I spent a long time yesterday with George Will. He was on the air for about a third of the interview that I did. All of it is posted at the interview with Hugh Hewitt, my podcast. And George Will and I talked a lot about Trump's impact on the Supreme Court. And we finally forced the discussion. George is a never Trumper, and I am a sometimes Trumper. And I said, George, you can either have Trump in the Supreme Court, or you can have Hillary and no Supreme Court, lost forever. It's that simple. And he resists that. So Trump's shadow is the Supreme Court and changing forever the way that Supreme Court nominees is up. That's the good news. Do you think that in order to be the Republican nominee and not be named Trump, you nevertheless have to have the endorsement of Trump?
Well, I think you have to reflect Trump attitudinally, and you have to reflect Trump from a particular policy perspective. Now, obviously, Trump adopted a lot of traditional Republicanism when you look at his judicial nominees, when you look at his policy on taxes and regulations, and some, and this is my analysis, some but not all aspects of his foreign policy. But attitudinally, he really reflected a shift in that he delivered to voters what they believed was somebody who was willing to fight everybody and pull no punches. And I think the Republican that will be successful in the Republican primary in 2024, if it's not Trump, is going to reflect that. They're going to have to do it in their own authentic way. If they try to ape Trump, the voters are going to smell a fraud and they're not going to like it. But I think the attitudinal shift and the reflection of Trump, the fighter, if you will, is one of the biggest impacts he is going to leave.
Yeah, there are lots of kinds of fighters out there, lots of kinds of fighters. But you've got to be combative to get the nomination. David, very quickly, I'll talk about this with your colleague, Byron York, at the top of the hour. Mitch McConnell has said, you broke it, you bought it. We're having nothing to do with the debt limit ceiling, put into reconciliation. We're having nothing to do with anything you're doing. You rolled us, so you've got it. There is no showdown. But I've got headlines in the Washington Post and the New York. There is no showdown. There's no showdown. They're not fighting. Do you agree with me?
Yeah, McConnell doesn't bluff. They're not going to budge. And either Democrats are going to hold a show vote so that they can then do what they're going to have to do, or they just don't realize what they're dealing with yet.
But he's not going to budge. There is no showdown. It's like Thanos showed up and the Avengers didn't.
Right.
All right. David Drucker is always right. That's why I'm going to read In Trump's Shadow. You can pre-order it now. I, of course, being a greedy radio host, want it sent to my... I don't want it sent to the studio or Sticky Fingers Band Mom will get it. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you, David. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt in California. For a week, we are honoring Pete Wilson at the Nixon Library this week. And I am so pleased to be a part of the salute to the former governor, former senator, former legislator, former mayor, former everything. Pete is everything good about public service. He's also a Marine. I'm joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner. Good morning, Byron.
Good morning, Hugh.
Byron, it's Cat Stevens Day at the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm just curious, you're not old enough, but are you a Cat Stevens aficionado?
Very, very excited about Cat Stevens Day. I heard you going on about it, you know. Look, Cat Stevens is fine. Leave him alone.
Well, no, there's a 10,000-word article on Cat Stevens in the Washington Post. Does that not surprise you?
It surprises me a little bit, but yeah, you know. Look, here's the thing: when one of these, especially musicians and songwriters, die at the end, they start playing all of these songs, and you think, "Wow, he actually did a bunch of good stuff." Well, Cat Stevens is not, he's not like he's on the Dylan or Paul Simon level, but he did a bunch of nice songs, and people like them. And when he emerges, now he's had a very bizarre life path, actually, but when he emerges into public view, people listen to the songs and they like them, so that's fine.
Well, I juxtapose it with the news blackout of John Andrzejczyk's song, Blood on My Hands, which was extremely critical of President Biden, Secretary Austin, and General Milley for the fiasco in Afghanistan. And, of course, Fox News and talk shows like mine talked about it. There's not a story anywhere. But they have space and writers for 10,000 words on Cat Stevens. It doesn't make a lot of sense what people choose to cover sometimes, Byron.
Well, I want to get agree with you on that.
I want to get to the key issue of the day. Mitch McConnell has said to Thanos, Chuck Schumer, you might want a showdown. We're not having a showdown. But every single paper from legacy media like the New York Times, Democrats pair spending bills with raising debt ceiling, pressuring GOP. Washington Post, Democrats unveil new plan to fund government, suspend debt ceiling as major showdown with GOP looms. There is no showdown, Byron. Am I correct?
Correct. On the basic issue of raising the debt ceiling. Historically, that's been something the majority party has to do. As the debt cliff approaches, there's a lot of whining and talking, and in the end, that's what the majority party has to do. And I believe, you know, you could raise the debt ceiling in a one-page bill. Democrats have what they call a majority, 50 votes in the Senate, plus the vice president, and they can pass it. And so that's something like that is going to happen unless they make some sort of deal that McConnell finds attractive.
Well, the brilliant thing about that is a debt ceiling bill requires 60 votes unless you attach it to reconciliation, in which case it only requires 50. They have reconciliation coming to conference. They can agree to do that, and they can get it done in 2 weeks. There need not be any crisis. Mitch is making them do their reconciliation bargaining among themselves now by refusing to go the wimpy route. And, you know, for a hamburger today, I will gladly buy you two Tuesday. He's just saying, no, you bought it. You broke it. You bought it. It's yours. And the media is outraged because they want to postpone the showdown between Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, and AOC in the hopes that something works out. And Chuck wants to postpone it as long as possible because he doesn't want her to run against him in the Democratic primary. Mitch McConnell's under no obligation to help them out of a political jam.
Here's the thing. We're seeing all of these stories about Democrats are beginning to panic about their entire agenda. The fundamental problem here is that the President, Joe Biden, the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, the Majority Leader, Charles Schumer, have all based the future of the Democratic agenda, the entire Democratic agenda, on a trick. And now they're worried that the trick might not work. They have ambitions to pass huge New Deal, Great Society style legislation, but they don't have the votes to do it. In the 1930s and the 1960s, Democrats had around 300 votes in the House, and somewhere between usually 65 and 75 seats in the Senate. Really, really big majorities. They could afford to lose some of their own members and still pass their legislation. That's completely different from the situation today where Nancy Pelosi has a four-seat, virtually zero majority in the House, and there actually isn't a majority in the Senate tied 50-50. So you have to use the vice president break the tie trick. You cannot pass sprawling, life-changing legislation in a 50-50 Senate. And so what they did was they've settled on the reconciliation idea, and they decided we'll pour our entire agenda, the whole thing, into a reconciliation bill, effectively getting around the filibuster for our entire agenda. We don't have the votes to get rid of the filibuster either, but we can effectively do that by pouring everything into this giant reconciliation bill. Well, hey, let's throw comprehensive immigration reform in there. We'll do that too. So they staked their entire agenda on a trick that cannot work.
And I want to reframe and restate that because I want the audience to understand. Reconciliation is an arcane process that allows tax and spending bills to pass with 50 votes once a year.
And they have to be germane to the budget.
Which is why the immigration fiasco didn't get through, because it's not germane to the budget. It's got to be substantially related to. It's got to actually have something to do with it in the ordinary course of business. So the Senate parliamentarian said to Chuck Schumer, no immigration stuff. Okay, big blow. But they can still agree among themselves on whatever they can agree among themselves and pass it with 50 votes, and they can put the debt limit on that. The debt limit has to be done along with a CR for spending. And the Democrats have to get together and figure out what they can get 50 senators to agree on. And Mitch is making them do that. I think it's brilliant.
Yes, and 50 senators, remember, is every single one of them. They can't lose any. That's the problem with trying to do, having these huge ambitions, this kind of weird pent-up demand that they displayed after the Trump years, and having these huge ambitions without the votes.
So legacy media, however, comes out. This is just a replay of the filibuster discussion. They never had the votes for the filibuster break. They will never have it because there's more than two. It's more than Sinema and Manchin. People just don't want to talk about it. They're never going to get rid of the filibuster until they get the 60 or 70 senators, which is unlikely. But the media tried to ask that question of Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema every day. Now, for the next many days, we are going to hear about a showdown that isn't a showdown, Byron. Does legacy media ever get ashamed of itself for inventing stories?
No. As a matter of fact, I mean, you kind of heard some frustration in my voice talking about this trick. They don't really emphasize, when they talk about the Senate majority leader, they don't really emphasize how tenuous this is and how in the past these giant bills passed with enormous majorities where, you know, significant parts of the party could peel off and the leaders could still pass the legislation. I mean, look in the 1930s, 300 plus Democrats in the House of Representatives. The Republican Party almost did not exist. And for those years between 65 and 69 in the Great Society, enormous majorities, pushing, you know, 68 senators, I think, in one of those terms. So they had the votes. Even when they passed Obamacare, if you remember, they briefly, and I'm talking about for about 3 months or so, had 60 votes in the Senate, and that's how they did it. And you can argue that if the American people elect 60 members of the Senate from one party, they really kind of want that party to be able to do what it wants, not the same when it's 50-50.
That is I believe that is point two. I think point number one that the media ought to report in every story is the Democrats can do whatever they want, literally whatever they want on taxing and spending. They can spend as much money as they want. They can raise or lower taxes. They can do whatever they want under the reconciliation rules, but they can't agree on what they want, so they want to blame Republicans. Isn't that the true story?
Absolutely the true story. The problem of only having 50 votes is they can't lose anybody. Let's say, and you're right, it's true, let's say they only had one doubter. It was Joe Manchin, and everybody else was on board, which is not really the case. But if it were true, they could lose him if they had 51 votes.
Yep.
If they had 52 votes.
They can't lose a single Democrat, so they have to get a Democratic consensus. The real story is the Democrats have to agree on how much to raise taxes and how much to spend, and then it can pass. Byron York is on Twitter. You ought to follow him. He's on Fox. You ought to watch him at Byron York. I'll be right back. America, it's the Hugh Hewitt Show.
The lost secret notebook of Nikola Tesla with his most dangerous formulas could fall into the hands of evolutionary elite scientists.
His most amazing discoveries, thought to be written in a lost journal. In the right hands, it could revolutionize the 21st century.
They want to start a new world order where elites rule and everyday people are not created equal.
Look out!
Now the elites plan to set off an earthquake under LA to take out world leaders.
There's an old brown battered notebook in my office at work. You have to find it, take it, and keep it hidden at all costs.
Let's just say there are a lot of enemies of the state interested in his research.
It's up to regular people to stop them. A grad student, a campus cop, a deaf army vet, and a group of live-action role players.
A vertical quake this size could collapse half of Dontop.
Catch Final Frequency, playing exclusively on SalemNow.com or download the mobile app. For more information, visit FinalFrequencyFilm.com.
Listen to the wind of my soul.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live in California this Tuesday morning. I'm playing Cat Stevens today because of this very vast article about his reemergence on the landing page of the Washington Post, which surprised me. So I didn't play the typical Admiral Stavridis music, but Admiral Stav, welcome back. I'm sure you were a Cat Stevens aficionado when you were young.
Oh, sure. I loved all the balladeers. They were all so good. James Taylor, I think, was my favorite of that generation. Carole King. But Cat Stevens, absolutely.
Yeah, but it's just odd to see him pop back up after 50 years. Admiral, I want to lead with the lead story breaking news out of Israel this morning. It hadn't even made it in the American press yet. Sudan claims to thwart military coup attempt, many officers detained. Now, I only bring this up because Sudan long ago and far away harbored Osama bin Laden under a radical Islamist regime. Have you been to Khartoum? You've usually been to everywhere. Have you been to Khartoum?
I have not. You finally caught me.
Finally! Finally. Well, I'm not surprised because it was an Islamist dictatorship forever, right?
Exactly. I think if I'd said yes, you should have been very suspicious.
Well, why do we care about places like Guinea and Sudan when coups happen, Admiral?
A, because of the overall rule of law we want to foster in the international community. It breaks norms when elected governments of whatever stripe are overthrown. B, geostrategically, we've seen again and again in these coup-ridden countries, bad actors bleed into it because they're largely ungoverned spaces in so many cases. And we've seen that from Afghanistan to Libya to Syria today to Sudan. I fear for it in Western Africa and Guinea. So I think those are the two principal reasons we ought to be concerned. One is kind of philosophical, political. The other is practical, military.
Now, I don't know if you've been to Guinea or Mogadishu and or other failed states, but I do know you can give us a fairly good idea. What is living in a failed state like?
It's pretty much like what you saw in Kabul over the last few weeks. It's masses of people, desperation in their eyes, extreme poverty, armed gangs, open trucks with skinny teenagers driving around with AK-47s. I'm describing both parts of East and West Africa at this point. All of those factors are part of this breakdown in lawlessness that ought to concern us very deeply in all of these countries.
You know, Jonah Goldberg wrote a great book a couple of years ago where he talked about the big man theory. In every failed state, a big man emerges, usually the guy with the most guns and skinny teenagers, and maybe out of that a state grows. Do you expect a civil war in Afghanistan, Admiral, after a period of time when these tribes fall back to what these tribes have always done, which is fight each other when they don't fight the West?
Certainly, that's the long and unfortunate history of Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban are still, you know, 2-3 weeks into this thing, playing their version of Taliban 2.0. I saw some shots yesterday of Haqqani, the minister of the interior, who has between a $5 and $10 million bounty on his head, depending on who you talk to, a pure terrorist, a dark, dark figure. Yet he's walking around Kabul effectively handing out candy in the streets. He's being kind and charming and smiling. That's kind of the face of the Taliban at the moment. If they keep that up, I think they've got a shot at avoiding a major breakdown. If they revert to their old practices, it's civil war right around the corner, because the northern alliances, the big tribes to the north, they don't want to be ruled by the Pashtuns in the south. Unfortunately, I would suspect that is the future of Afghanistan. We ought to care for the reasons we just talked about, Hugh, which are That leads to ungoverned spaces. That leads to the rise of Al-Qaeda. That provides safe haven to Islamic State. That's what we need to avoid being surprised on. All the more reason that we maintain an intelligence capability in Afghanistan, as difficult as that's going to be.
Now, Admiral, I want you to put on the Secretary of State hat that many people believed you were going to wear should Hillary Clinton have won the 2016 election. And tell me what you would do if you were sitting on the seventh floor of the State Department and this submarine controversy arose. And you might want to recap it for people who didn't listen to us talk about it last week. You were on the air with me when the story broke.
Yeah, in very short strokes, Australia signed up for France to build diesel electric submarines, which are pretty good. But over the last week or so, they have done a 180 and signed up with the United States and the United Kingdom to build vastly better nuclear-powered submarines. The French have lost a multi-billion-dollar contract. They are outraged. What I would have done in retrospect was spend more time speaking with our allies, the French, our oldest allies, the First Nation who came and fought alongside us in the Revolutionary War. They're very fond of pointing that out. As you know, we subsequently fought a small war with them, but such was the 19th century. At the moment, they're still very strong allies within NATO, and so this came across to them as very bad industrial policy, but also a real stab in the back to an ally. If I were sitting in Tony Blinken's shoes right now, and Tony, by the way, interestingly, is a francophonic. He speaks beautiful French, lived in France for many years. I think he is and ought to be the point man on trying to rebuild this, at the moment, quite shaky set of relationships. And it's not just France, Hugh. It's also with Europe broadly. We see, particularly in the wake of Brexit, as the United Kingdom pulls out, we now see France taking a lead in Germany and working toward a much more independent EU policy. That'll bleed into our efforts to stand up to China. That's why this is important. I think Secretary Blinken, that ought to be pretty much at the top of his chat list right now, is working with his counterparts in Paris.
Now, Admiral, in the compartmentalization of presidents in my head, I remember Ike's memoir of the European campaign, Crusade in Europe. And I remember that de Gaulle was famously difficult to get along with. Churchill had many, many funny de Gaulle stories because he was very French. And Nixon had very many de Gaulle stories because, of course, he was a great man. He's an extraordinary man, but very prickly. And the French seem to have that prickliness in everything. They can't actually expect Australia to go with a second-class sub as China continues to pump out frigate submarines and aircraft carriers, can they?
No, they cannot. And I think that this is more about the atmospherics, the style, the disrespect that they feel. By the way, Charles de Gaulle, in addition to all the difficult qualities you mentioned, as someone who's 5'6" tall, I'm required to point out that he's one of these classic, difficult, very tall men. In any event, hey, the Australians made the right decision for three very quick reasons. One is geography. The Pacific is vast. Diesel submarines cannot get the job done. They literally have to be up on that diesel cranking along. You can hear them a million miles away. Geography. Number two, geopolitically, they want to be aligned with the major power in the Pacific. That is not France. It is the United States. And number three, your point, technology. These nuclear submarines are unbelievably quiet. They can master the Chinese fleet. They are, we talked about this last week, the queen of the battlefield, like a chess piece. The queen can go anywhere, anytime she chooses. That's a nuclear submarine. The Aussies have made the right choice.
Now, Admiral, my friend Captain Mark Vandroff, retired now with Marinette, has the Vandroff Doctrine, which is if a weapon system is purchased by a third country that is not obliged to purchase it, it proves its efficacy. So the F-35 has been proven because it's acquired by countries that don't have to buy the F-35. They can buy from France or other places. The Vandroff corollary is it's always good to sell weapon systems to our allies because then we train their fill-in-the-blank pilots. Will we be training the Australian submariner community now more than we previously had? Do we expect, for example, them to go to nuke school in Charleston?
They will certainly be trained by the U.S. If I were structuring this, and a good friend of mine, a retired three-star Navy nuclear submariner, one of the absolute best in the business, is working this right now, the details of how we do the technology transfer, how we do the training transfer that you allude to. Let's not forget the Brits are in this, and the Brits run very capable nuclear submarines and have a long tradition of operating a very competent submarine force. So they'll be involved as well. But I think it'll be the lion's share of this will come from the United States. By the way, I know Captain Mark Vandroff very well from my days as an Aegis commander. And another good example of a system that other nations don't have to buy, but they do, is the Aegis combat system, the air defense systems on our cruisers and destroyers. Japanese have it. The Spanish have it. The Australians have it. It's a system very much like the one you mentioned, the F-35.
Well, given, last question, given that the Naval Academy takes these young submariners and builds them up and they go there to learn and then they go there to qualify and they have nuclear submarines on the mind, eventually they have to learn how to run the reactors as well. Do you expect Australian midshipmen to be at Annapolis?
There already is a small exchange program along with many other nations. We have Colombian midshipmen, and we have midshipmen from every nation almost within the NATO alliance. But yes, I think you'll see an upsurge in the number of Australians coming through. And we could not have better partners. Australia has stood with us in every single war we've fought since they were independent and we were independent, including unpopular ones like Vietnam and Iraq. The Aussies have always been with us. I've been to every state and territory in Australia over the years. And on top of all that, they make the best Shiraz wine in the world down in Adelaide and Hunter and Barossa Valleys. Can't beat the Australians.
A question is, though, how will the Aussie mids get along with Annapolis discipline at the United States Naval Academy? That doesn't seem like a good match.
I think they'll get along a lot better with the Maryland young ladies than they will with the disciplinarians at the Naval Academy. But trust me, they'll get through it.
Admiral James Stavridis, always a pleasure. Author of 2034, along with Elliot Ackerman, best-selling novel. You ought to go and get it now because it really does look into the future. 2034. That's when you need to talk about the French and the Australians. I hope the networks just put the admiral on. He gets it. He understands it. Great diplomat. But the bottom line is Australia has to do what's in the best interest of Australia. That meant going with us and the UK as the whatever, AUKUS coalition gets underway. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live in California. Thank you for joining me this morning. I am joined by Arizona's Governor Doug Ducey, America's best governor, longtime friend of mine. Good morning, Doug Ducey. How are you, Governor?
Real good, Hugh. How are you? Good to hear your voice.
I'm glad I am not you, because I honestly do not know what I would do with this number. I've read the letter that the RGA sent the president that you signed. I have read the press releases. The numbers are astonishing. Would you review the letter that you sent to President Biden, what you were asking for and why you were asking for it?
Well, Hugh, this is beyond a border crisis. And of course, people know Arizona and Texas are border states, but 26 governors from across the country have signed on to this because it's really beyond just a border crisis. It's a catastrophe, and it's things like including a national security crisis because we don't know who's coming across our southern border. It's a public safety crisis because all of our states are experiencing a rise in crime and drugs. It's a humanitarian crisis. You can see that just from the pictures. And then, of course, we're told we have this public health crisis, yet when inconvenient at the border, the Biden administration averts its gaze from what's actually happening there, and there's not testing or vaccination. So governors together, all Republicans, have stepped up and said to President Biden that you need to act on this. It's the responsibility of the federal government, and we've requested a meeting with him within the next 2 weeks. We want to go to Washington, D.C., and bring back the policies of the previous administration that were actually working at the border.
Now, Governor Ducey, for the benefit of people, new affiliates that may not know you, you are like the most responsible guy ever when it comes to confronting a problem. After the school shootings, you convened experts, you brought in every stakeholder, you had a serious policy, got adopted, became a model. What are you doing in Arizona that might model for the rest of the country? You're not a shoot from the hip guy. You're a businessman. You've run a great state. You have huge approval. What do you do with this many people? Because I read in the press release, it's up 500% over last year.
It's up 500%, and it's not so much the statistics, and we could just give people all kinds of data that would shock them. For Jen Psaki to say that we had a slight decrease when we're at a 20-year high of what's happening here at the border, and we know how long this has been an issue, is just misinformation. And, you know, you hear the Mexican president calling Joe Biden the migrant president. You hear the Guatemalan president saying that Joe Biden's messaging is confusing, and you wonder why the Haitian people have come here. It's because they think they're welcome, because of what's coming out of the White House is that they are anti-wall and they're absent without leave on what's happening at the border. So what I have done, and Governor Abbott has done this as well, is we've deployed our own National Guard. Other Republican presidents have sent us additional law enforcement, but when you don't have California or New Mexico participating with you, when you don't have the faith and help of the federal government, when you've got ICE and CBP and border agents so discouraged and underfunded, that's what you see. I mean, these pictures just spell Bidenville of people living under an underpass between Mexico and the United States, and it needs the action and responsibility of the federal government to address it, and we need it with urgency.
Now, you referenced Jen Psaki. For the benefit of the audience who were not listening last hour, I want to play the White House press secretary yesterday talking about whether or not things are under control at the border, cut number 7.
Where's the vice president on any of this? Isn't she supposed to be addressing the root causes of migration?
Absolutely. And she has been addressing the root causes of migration by working with countries in the region to ensure they have the assistance they need to reduce the number of people who are coming and trying to make those journeys across the border. We've actually seen some reductions in some of those numbers. That doesn't change the fact that this is a very challenging situation in Del Rio. We're working to implement our policies, and we're working to ensure we are also addressing root causes.
First question, Governor, has the vice president called you recently about the Arizona border?
I have not talked to the vice president. I've asked her to come to the Arizona border along with the Secretary of Homeland Security. And if the vice president is looking for the root causes of what's happening, she needs to look no further than the Oval Office. This is a change in policies from the Trump-Pence administration, things like Title 42, Remain in Mexico, the Migrant Protection Program, and then, of course, the physical barrier. The actual wall that said to people, we are not welcoming illegal migration to this country. We have an immigration system. We encourage you to follow it legally. But if you remember, Hugh, during the debates, and I know you do remember, when all the Democrats were asked,
Would they give people illegally crossing the border free health care? Every one of them, including Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, raised their hand, yes, free health care. We actually had Martha Raddatz come to the border. Kamala Harris didn't, but ABC News did. And she asked migrants that had crossed illegally, did they come because Joe Biden was president? They answered that yes, they felt that they were welcomed here. And then she asked, would you have come if Donald Trump was president? And they said, not a chance.
So, Governor Ducey, they have been in office, the president and the vice president, for 8 months. How often has Vice President Harris, with authority delegated to her by the president to control the border, how many times has she called you?
She's not called me once.
What?
She was the worst possible choice to be the border czar. She's shown no level of seriousness on this issue throughout her entire career. And once she got the assignment, she tried to change the definition of what success would be. She dillied and dallied until she went to other countries to visit, and she still has not come to Arizona's border. I know she did a flyby in Texas, but Governor Abbott wasn't invited to that. And this is really about convening the stakeholders, the ranchers, law enforcement, federal authorities, the National Guard, talking about how you can solve the problem. And then the policies that I ticked off from Title 42 to migrant protection protocols that actually worked, that actually disincented people from coming across. Right now, Hugh, we've got the drug cartels are shaping the policy on the border, taking advantage of hundreds of thousands of people with their life savings. And again, we can kick off the encounters that we know, the people that we've actually been able to apprehend. It's the people that we haven't apprehended that keep you up at night, that make you wonder where they are and who they are and what intention they have in this country.
Governor Ducey, you've been governor for, this is your seventh year. So you were governor under President Obama. Was the border this lawless under President Obama?
It was not even close, but President Obama, of course, did not have the same focus on the border as President Trump did, but he knew what a crisis was. And even Barack Obama deployed the National Guard to the border. Of course, Donald Trump did. Of course, George W. Bush did the same. But when Donald Trump deployed the National Guard to the border, even Jerry Brown put California's National Guard at the border. So this is a national issue. It's been dealt with by other presidents except Joe Biden. So this is a solvable problem. The wall, the physical border, is part of this. So much of it has been built. It just needs to be completed. It keeps people and drug cartels from spilling over. And it also sends a message that if you want to come here, go through the legal process, if you have asylum claims, please make them. But there's a way to do it that doesn't allow people to come over the border to actually game the system and then to just fade into the country, never to be seen again.
Governor Ducey, in one of the releases that the RGA sent out and your office sent out, it reports that the Yuma Sector Border Patrol experienced a more than 900% increase in apprehensions compared to last year. Tucson, a 200% increase. And to put a human face on it, a few weeks ago, a mother and her 10-year-old daughter who crossed the border seeking asylum were found dead from heat exposure in the Yuma desert. I cannot believe the president and the vice president are frozen, and Secretary Mayorkas frozen. A press conference is not a policy.
It's heartbreaking, Hugh, because you do see these pictures. They tell a thousand words, and the fact that people think that our government is welcoming them to take that dangerous, if not deathly, journey across the Sonoran Desert at the height of summer with triple-digit figures and no water along the way. And then when you see the sexual abuse statistics and the violence statistics of what people face on that journey from the drug cartels, it's doubly bad. And the administration's aware of it, but there's been a complete lack of action. It's like they're frozen, focusing on Afghanistan. And then in so many ways, Hugh, I think this mandate around vaccines was a very cynical effort to just change the news story about the rupture at our southern border.
It's a rupture. That's exactly what it is. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, always great to talk to you, Governor. Good luck. This is a crisis. I hope the president agrees to meet with the governors at the White House. Thank you, Governor. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. I'm Hugh Hewitt, and I'll be right back live from California this morning.
Hear the latest reporting and analysis on the big stories of the day on the Daybreak Insider podcast. It's top-notch reporting from SRN News, along with the sharpest insight from Hugh Hewitt, Mike Gallagher, Dennis Prager, Sebastian Gorka, and the voices of townhall.com. The Daybreak Insider podcast. It's your first look at today's top stories. Available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and at salempodcastnetwork.com.
Boats are coming to win us, they're coming to win us, they're coming to win us. The longer boats are coming to win us, hold on to the shore.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. That's Cat Stevens, because the Washington Post published 10,000 words on Cat Stevens today. I'm playing Cat Stevens. I don't know why they did. They just chose today. Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas is my guest. Good morning, Senator Cotton. You're not much of a Cat Stevens fan, I assume.
Good morning, Hugh. It's good to be on with you. It's nice bumper music, but I can't say no that I have his whole selector works.
Okay. Well, I really want to talk to you today about two stories. One in the New York Times, headline, Democrats to pair spending bill with raising debt ceiling, pressuring GOP, and one in the Washington Post about the same thing, putting pressure on the GOP by virtue of this bill. Senator Cotton, is the GOP under any pressure whatsoever? I've listened to Leader McConnell. It leads me to believe that there actually is no confrontation, no showdown, no pressure.
No, Hugh, I feel zero pressure from the Democrats. Senator McConnell, from his public statement, obviously feels no pressure. And I can tell you that our caucus is united, from our more centrist members to our members on the far right. And that this simple belief, if the Democrats want to pass $6 trillion of new spending this year on a party line basis, then they can pass the debt ceiling increase that will accommodate that $6 trillion on a party line basis as well. And the refusal to do so is the ultimate case of eating elephants and choking on gnats.
You know, I believe that the correct headline would be, Democrats in House, Democrats in Senate in disarray, cannot agree on how much to raise taxes and to spend and debt ceiling. Isn't that the correct headline as opposed to putting pressure on GOP? They're just in disarray.
They are in total disarray, although I guess that implies that they were at one point in array, and I'm sure you want to concede that point, Hugh. And remember what we're talking about here, Hugh. This is not their massive, reckless, unprecedented $3.5 trillion tax hike and spending bill. This is just a spending bill to keep the lights on in the federal government next Friday. This is just the annual spending bills and the debt ceiling increase necessitated by their spending blowout this year. And then, as you point out, when you get to that reckless tax hike and spending bill, they are in total disarray and they're at daggers drawn, attacking each other in the most vicious and personal terms. Maybe they should therefore think about going back to the drawing board and not trying to remake American society with the razor-thin margins the American people gave them last fall, and on which Joe Biden did not campaign.
Now, given the fact that reconciliation allows them, they've passed, they're on the diving board and they're jumping. They put the diving board in place. They can do whatever they want, up to $3.5 trillion of spending. They can raise as many taxes as they want. They can lower as many taxes as they want. And they can raise the debt limit. They can also do the CR. They can do whatever they want to do on tax and spending and debt limit and continuing resolution. All they have to do is agree. They don't need any Republican votes. Am I correct if they agree?
Hugh, that is almost correct, with the exception of the so-called continuing resolution, which keeps the government open at the end of the month. Now, I can tell you the Republican votes would be there as long as they don't try to connect it to the debt ceiling increase to pay for their record spending spree this year, and as long as they don't include extreme immigration matters that would treat some of these Afghan evacuees more generously than we treat the Afghans who served alongside us and received special immigrant visas. But if they want to pass a spending bill that keeps the government open until December, there will be plenty of Republican votes for that. Everything else, Hugh, can be done on reconciliation, and that is Senator McConnell's point. He said time and again that the United States must never default on our debts. However, it's not just a theoretical proposition that the Democrats can use reconciliation to pass it with Democratic votes alone. They are literally writing a reconciliation bill right now, so they have the perfect and timely means to raise the debt ceiling on their own to pay for their spending blowout that they are passing on their own.
Now, my theory behind these headlines, Democrats unveil new plan to fund government, suspend debt ceiling as major showdown with GOP looms. That's the Washington Post. And the New York Times, Democrats to pair spending bill with raising debt ceiling, pressuring GOP, is part of legacy media's ongoing effort to make Republicans the bad guys. But I want to go back to the bottom line point. If Democrats can simply get their act together and agree among themselves on how much to spend, how much to tax, they can put that on the floor with a debt ceiling and pass it with no Republican votes. Is that factually correct?
Factually correct, Hugh. Another way of putting it is the Democrats' problem isn't that they don't have 60 votes right now. It's that they don't have 50 votes right now. Or they don't have 218 votes because they cannot agree among themselves what taxes to increase in their record tax hike or what programs to create or to spend more money on in their unprecedented $6 trillion spending blowout. That's their problem.
And so Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer are endangering the full faith and credit. I believe everything Secretary Yellen has said. It's a disaster not to raise the debt limit. But it's up to the Democrats to raise the debt limit. And they are talking to television cameras and reporters as opposed to each other. Am I right?
That's right, Hugh. They're taking a page from Joe Biden's blame shifting on the Afghanistan debacle. Joe Biden said the buck stopped with him, but blamed everyone under the sun, from Donald Trump to the military to our intelligence agencies, even to normal Afghans. And now the Democrats are blaming everyone but themselves for what they could and should do on their own, which is raise the debt ceiling to accompany their party line spending blowout.
Now, if they got AOC and one of the nine House moderate Democrats, plus Chuck Schumer and Joe Manchin, plus the president in a room, they could get to a bottom line, could they not?
Okay, first, let me correct you. There are no moderate Democrats in the House. There are only vulnerable Democrats.
Okay, well put, well put.
But that's basically what they have to do, Hugh. They have to quit talking past each other. They have to quit talking to each other through the media, and they have to settle on what they want to do themselves. And if that means that they can't achieve the full left-wing progressive wish list that they pursued earlier this year, they have to take a step back and take a step toward responsible governance, which is increasing the debt ceiling with their own votes, since they've been passing party-line bills on this unprecedented spending spree this year, then that's exactly what they could.
So I want to emphasize, not one Republican senator, not one, will defect on a debt limit and run via the continuing resolution. Am I right?
I would be very surprised at any defections, Hugh. I can say there is no chance, and I mean zero chance, that 10 Republican senators will vote with the Democrats on that.
And the Democrats know this.
The Democrats have known it for at least 2 months. Has been cautioning them since July that while they were crafting their party-line budget that they wanted to spend $3.5 trillion on, they should add a party-line debt ceiling increase.
So if there is a debt limit crisis and it does shatter markets and confidence in the dollar, it will be the fault of the Democrats, no matter how many headlines they have in legacy media and on unwatched cable television channels. It will be on them.
Yes, it'll be the Democrats' sole responsibility. I hope it won't come to that. I hope that they will get through the stages of grief sooner rather than later and take the steps that they should have taken starting 2 months ago.
How many Senate Democrats do they have to actually negotiate with? Is it 5, 6, 7, or is it just Senators Manchin and Sinema?
Very few, Hugh. I mean, you have vulnerable Democratic senators like Maggie Hassan and Kathy Cortez Masto, who may, put out a press release here and there to reassure their sensible voters back home. But in reality, they've told Chuck Schumer they'll vote for whatever he puts on the floor. So you have a couple senators here and there on certain issues, like Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema on this bill, that require genuine negotiations. But most of these Democrats in the House and the Senate are just rubber stamps for whatever Pelosi and Schumer put on the board.
Are there any Democrats who will stop the doubling of the death tax, who will stop the erasure of stepped up bases, who will stop confiscatory capital gains hike increases?
Well, you know, at least on the question of stepped up basis, we didn't just get any Democrat. We got 50 of them last month. We voted 99-0 in the budget that set up this framework for their spending bill. And we should not eliminate stepped-up basis, because it would be a huge and confiscatory tax on family farmers and ranchers and foresters and small businesses. It would be an unprecedented break with practice. Now, when they're scrounging for money, trying to find every last dime they can to take out of your pocket and spend it on their priorities, like welfare for illegal aliens, who's to say they'll stick to their principles in that vote? But I was pleased that even the far-left Democrats recognized that that would be a radical departure and a confiscatory tax.
But they're not bound by that, right? They can still write the bill any way they want.
Yes, that's correct. You.
And so will they double? I mean, is there anyone on their side who at least pretends not to want to double the death tax?
Probably some of their rich Democrats, like your senator out there in California, Hugh.
Dianne Feinstein wants to keep her money when her estate passes to her heirs.
I would imagine that some of those rich Democrats, of whom there are more than a few, would not like to pay the confiscatory tax. And that's one reason why in their proposals in the House, you've seen steep increases, but not what Joe Biden and the far left had wanted earlier this year.
So just project. We got a minute left, Senator. If they actually sat down and did their job, since they run everything and they've got reconciliation authority, what number do you think they'll end up doing in terms of deficit spending with the debt limit? And how much will they totally spend? Will it be $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion, $3 trillion? And how many taxes will they raise?
Hugh, I once tried to put myself inside the minds of Democrats, and it was a deep, dark abyss, and I stepped backward, and I've never done it again. So I won't try to project. I will say this, the number should be zero for almost every initiative they propose. And rather, we should be spending that new money, if we're going to have any new money at all, on our military, which under Joe Biden's budget saw a real cut after inflation, while he was proposing that every other department of the government give huge increases. But given the dangerous world, made more dangerous by Joe Biden's fiasco in Afghanistan, the only thing that we should be increasing spending on right now is our military.
Well, please applaud the caucus when you get together next on behalf of the American electorate, because they ran to run everything. They've got everything. They caught the car. It's the dog that caught the milk truck or the mail truck. Now they have to govern. I'm glad you guys are doing this and gals the right way. Thank you, Senator Cotton. Talk to you next week.
Thank you, Hugh.
I really am glad. They own it. Democrats are in disarray. It is not Mitch McConnell's job to fix it for them.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.